The following is a meeting with devotees with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, recorded on August 14, 2001, in Innisfil, Ireland.
So I'm hoping to give classes here every day at this time for about an hour and 15 minutes each class, including questions. And to make it easy for myself, rather than preparing a lecture each class, I'm doing something that I've done before. Maybe some of you were present in Vrindavan, in Mayapur Vrindavan Trust Room, when I was there, many of my disciples were there. We were dividing time up into about four different subjects. We would go from one thing to another. So I'm doing that. And I've got about four or five. I may not divide them exactly, although I do have a stopwatch. But especially today, there's going to be more time spent on one thing than another. And on one day, something may be left off completely. But I hope we'll cover our time. We won't be fanatical about the time division. As long as we're going strong on something, that's the main thing. We keep up our interest. So I'll tell you what the divisions are. I want to do some excerpt reading and commenting on the Mahabharata. That'll be first. And then a break, so to speak, of a 5-minute japa together. And then a section on Vrindavan, which will consist of me reading something that I've written about Vrindavan or that I've quoted about Vrindavan, and then asking for participation from the devotees, some comment on some experience of theirs in Vrindavan. We call that Bhoma Vrindavan in India, or about Vrindavan as we read it in the scriptures in the spiritual world, or the non-difference of them both. Then, let's see, what do I have next? Well, at some point I have Prabhupada meditations. Maybe that's going to have one, two, yeah, that's it. Prabhupada meditations will be the fourth thing, the last thing. And I think after each section, I could ask for any questions and comments before we move to the next. So, first I'd like to tell you my personal revival of interest, or almost birth of interest, in the Mahabharata. I dipped into it, like every ISKCON devotee, for decades, although I wasn't raised on it like ISKCON kids. And I never got so far. I did listen to Sri Galim's recording of it, sometimes while traveling in a van or car. I read things in Prabhupada's books, references that it's not the most important book compared to Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, because it stresses dharma, kama, artha, moksha, the four kinds of material activities, and not pure devotional service. So, what changed my feeling for Mahabharata is, and I can't be ashamed to say what it was watching a film by Peter Brook, which I watched in three installments, each of an hour and a half. It's an epic long film, and it's an example of how art can just penetrate a person's attitude towards spirituality. We were talking a little bit about that. Whenever I try to make a little speech about art and Krishna consciousness, I feel I'm always fumbling and I'm always scratching the surface, or rather it's something you really can't talk about. As I tried to say something after the dance and before my slideshow. But I know, I think it can only be, on one hand, those kind of talks, and art itself can only be appreciated by artists themselves, as they appreciate art and Krishna consciousness, maybe because they want to do art, and they're glad to hear it justified. But my experience with this film was that, of course I don't watch movies, so just the just to be able to see something very absorbing in the film medium was tremendous. One film I had watched 2 years in a row was Jesus of Nazareth by Zeffirelli, and that was very absorbing for me. It was like almost my education in Christianity. And my knowledge of all the different persons in the life of Christ came more by that film and the persons in it and the way they express themselves by anything else. And I was maybe a little envious too, unconsciously or consciously, that Christian tradition had this great film in addition to all the other things they have, beautiful cathedrals and so forth, to present their teachings of Christ. And of course we have beautiful cathedrals in India, but not so much Western art, especially contemporary. So this this film made such an impact on me, and more than anything else it was the casting, the persons who were playing the parts. Each of them was so convincing. In the Zeffirelli film, I don't know those of you who've seen it, it was once presented as a mini series on TV, and it has many top Hollywood actors. They appear in some small part. Those who are famous for many other films that they took part in. Anne Bancroft, Anthony Quinn, Ernest Borgnine, etc., etc., etc. They all appear. I think Sir Laurence Olivier and all these famous actors take part in it. Well, I don't think this film has anybody like that in it. But he selected all these characters who are more perfect than those big shots. The multi-race was one feature of it. There's Bhishma is played by an African man. Bhima is played by a Caribbean African man. And Arjuna has a strong Italian accent. And sometimes when I'm alone, I imitate these. I wouldn't dare to do it here, but I love Arjuna's accent. But they're perfect. Karna is an extraordinary person. He has great physical strength, and it looks like a kind of a mixed Caucasian and black, and very mysterious looking person. And you hate the bad guys and you love the good guys. Draupadi is a classical Indian, young, beautiful woman. One of the few Indians. There's quite a few Orientals. Gandhari is an Oriental. So forth. It's a rather low-budget film. The spectacular is in the acting. Moment to moment, and in the screenplay, they change things from the Mahabharata, but that
poetic justice can be given. The only major character who was weak was Krishna. He's kind of like a faded middle-aged British person. and he speaks with a sort of pseudo-religious voice all the time to show that he's not just a human being. At least they were careful to show that he was, to tell that he was an incarnation of Vishnu. But in order to portray that, he speaks in kind of a not quite human, but all-knowing religious voice, which is a little annoying. It would be hard to know how to do that, I guess, but at least he could have been a beautiful male, which he isn't. So I was really enthralled to watch that. And after that, then I found Hridayananda Maharaj's tapes. I did about a dozen tapes or so, mostly reading his translations, and also one or two times speaking the whole thing, speaking the philosophy without translating. And he was always so witty, and always so, he spoke with great knowledge of the whole Mahabharata and the Vedic culture. So that was a good follow-up for my appetite after this film. Unfortunately, he stopped after only a few stories. So then the next logical thing for me to do was to read the Mahabharata. And so I've been reading for about 10 minutes a day, only a couple of times a day with Hari Bhakti Vilas. And I thought I would read here a little excerpt and maybe make some little comments. For a while, just like I told you with the Zeffirelli film, Christianity meant he said, oh, remember in the film they did it like this, remember in the film they did it like that, just like kids after they see the movie they keep talking about. So when we read the Mahabharata, we would say how they had done it in the film. I may do some of that too. Oh, when Hridayananda Maharaj began to speak, he may have had changing attitudes toward it. I don't know, I'm not in touch with him, but this is around 1991. He first made strong presentations against the conception that the Mahabharata is a materialistic, lesser class shastra. And he picked things out from Prabhupada's books to say that it eventually leads to pure devotional service. And he read in the first chapter, which we usually don't see in these books, there are long prayers to Krishna, Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so he, along the way, was reinforcing this way that everything is there, and it's not just like there's that one devotee asked. These questions were given in an assembly of devotees, usually Los Angeles, and someone said, "But I thought this scripture was for women less intelligent and shudras," is some quote, and he said. Yeah, I think he looked around at the audience and he said, yes, well, who else is here? and he was very much feeling for Mahabharata and not wanting it to be put down. I like it because the same reason the children like it, it's full of so many stories, well, one after another. I think especially in these condensed forms that they've been put together by devotees of Krishna Dharma. Oh, so I wanted to play Prabhupada talking about Mahabharata in a very nice, you notice the tones of his voice also, his very relaxed speech as he speaks Mahabharata. You play that?
So there
Louder.
Is a response, you see, raise the fatherless children. So, Dhritarashtra took charge as the eldest member. The Maya is very strong. He began to think that actually this kingdom belongs to me. I am the eldest son, but because I am born blind, therefore it was given to my younger brother. Now he is dead. So the property belongs to me. Somehow or other it was transferred to my younger brother. Now the younger brother is dead. Then again I become proprietor. So at least I could not rule over the kingdom. Why not my son? This was the beginning. Just like one of our god brother, he is thinking that this institution was started by me and Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati as partners. Now the senior partner is there, therefore I am the sole proprietor. Who are these god brothers? Remember. So this is Maya, the same Maya Dhritarashtra was thinking, and his brother-in-law Shakuni was very expert in conspiracy. So he was advising him, yes, you are the proprietor, at least your son should be. This is natural. Everyone has got some affection for the family. So this is the beginning of the conspiracy. Otherwise he was taking care of the children very nicely. But Maya was dictating that you are taking care of the children of your brother. What about your own children? Yes, why not my children? So attempt was being made how to kill this boy. The first attempt was to administer poison.
Turn off. First attempt was made to administer poison. So then he doesn't tell anything about that poison. So I can start with that. So Duryodhan and his brothers, they poisoned Bhima of the five. He was the strongest. So if they could kill him, then the Pandavas would be the most reduced in strength. So they were all almost boys, not fully grown up. And they planned to have a big picnic at some very nice swimming spot and playing spot, and then have a feast. So all the boys liked the idea, and they were playing in the water, and Bhima, as usual, was tossing all the boys around in the wrestling, most energetic. And then in the feast, they put in his foods and cakes and pies and creams huge amounts of poison. He then offered the plate to Bhima, feigning love and feeding him with his own hand. The guileless Bhima suspected nothing, and he cheerfully consumed his normal amount. Hridayananda Maharaj makes comments that for much of the early Mahabharata, this idea of not suspecting anything wrong on the part of the Pandavas was there. You could almost call it naivete, was because they never thought that they were so pure and trusting. They never thought of the evil and the cunning that the Duryodhana and the others had. And so in this way they were cheated and again and again, and this whole gambling match they submitted to it, but then at a certain point, they, as he said, they snapped, and then they realized that the other side were cheaters, and they determined to kill them, to retaliate and to kill them. But you see, the Pandav is undergoing a lot of innocent mistreatment because they really don't understand how evil the other side is. Late in the afternoon, the boys began to tire. They came out of the water and dressed themselves in white robes adorned with gold ornaments. Then they wearily made their way back to the mansion to spend the night. Bhima had consumed enough poison to kill 100 men, but it was not until the evening that the wind god's son began to feel its effects. As night fell, he felt so drowsy that he decided to lay down by the river and rest. Gradually, he lapsed into a deep sleep. So the other princes had gone back to the palace, but Duryodhana and Dushasana, they went back to Bhima, and they tied him up in ropes, and they pushed him into the water to drown. So Bhima sank to the bottom of the river and was carried by underwater currents. The celestial abode of the divine serpent beings, the Nagas, could be reached through the Ganges, and Bhima was swept along a mystical path right into their midst. At once the snakes began to bite the humans so suddenly arrived among them. Their virulent poison proved to be the antidote to the plant poison Duryodhana had administered. So they were biting him, but it turned out to be a cure. He woke to find himself on a strange riverbank surrounded by large serpents bearing their fangs. Bhima burst the cords binding his limbs. He picked up the snakes and dashed them to the ground. He pressed some into the earth with his feet and hurled others to a distance. Seeing him render dozens of snakes unconscious, the others fled away in terror. So then these Nagas, they go to their king, Vasuki, and tell him what this person is doing. And he takes a human form, and he appears before Bhima in a happy and submissive form, and he says, "What can we do for you?" And then they decide to give Bhima some drink, rasa, which will make him very strong. And they invite him to drink. Bhima sat facing the east, and as he always did before eating or drinking, offered prayers to the Lord. He then lifted one of the large pots of rasa and quaffed it down in one gulp. The Nagas watched in amazement as Bhima drank 8 pots of the divine elixir, each in a single draft. Even the most powerful among them would not have been capable of such a feat. After Bhima had satisfied himself with the rasa, he again felt drowsy, and they give him a bed and he sleeps for 8 days. After that, he awakes, and the Nagas say, "You now have the strength of 10,000 elephants, and you'll be invincible in battle." So he then hurries back to the palace where his mother and the boys are all waiting for him, and where Duryodhana and the others say, "Oh, damn, he's still alive." So that, as Prabhupada said, that was one attempt to kill him by poison. Now I'll hear some more attempts.
The Dhritarashtra constructed a house of cell. So they are transparent. By their bias, for some days it can leak in that house that is very nice. Vidhu gave him hint. So that you are being sent there, be careful for being killed. The house will be set fire. So Vidhu was very favorable to the Pandavas. So they made a survey in that house, and when the house was set fire, they escaped through the survey. In this way, it is said, Vishan Mahagne set fire in Sherlock house, just like nowadays is what is called plastic. It gets set fire very soon. then Vrindavan.
Okay, turn it. So, I think we've used up our Mahabharata time. Are there any questions or comments? Yeah.
I saw a movie, Indian movie about the Mahabharata, and this episode we see five people coming from outside in the log house.
Yeah.
And they are burned into this house.
Yeah. Yeah, it's told that it was a Sudra lady and her sons, so that they were drunk, so when the fire came, they didn't move, and so then in the morning, when the remains are seen, people think it's like further proof for them that actually Mother Kunti and the boys were burned, and they placed the guilt on Purochana, who's an agent of Duryodhana.
I just thought it was very nice the way Prabhupada called the tunnel a subway.
Yeah. Personal touch. Mm-hmm. Subway. Yeah.
As far as like our own reading, should like that be like supplementary, like make sure we read Prabhupada's books and if we have spare time and read them out more too?
Yeah. It's a very big book. I'm only getting to it after 35 years. I had, last year I was reading, discovered for the first time and with great enthusiasm, the Chaitanya Bhagavat. I was reading that with devotees. That's a very wonderful, important book. But, I always thought there's no need to even read the Mahabharata. But it's so delightful that just you can read it also. It just shows what a wealth of literature we have. So if you've read these other books, essential books, again and again and again, and you want some variety, you can read this also. And it's good for your Krishna conscious knowledge to have background of these stories, and like Prabhupada is telling long stories. They're contained in the first canto. There's quite a bit of it also, of Mahabharata in the purports. Yeah.
I've also had this book, and also Krishna Dharma's Ramayana.
Uh-huh.
And being an avid follower of Srila Prabhupada, I found he really expertly puts a lot of Srila Prabhupada into the books. That when if there's somebody just reading this book, and a lot of people, like I understand, are buying these books that would just buy them out of a bookstore.
Yeah.
And like the Ramayana is infused with reminders that this is Krishna, this is an incarnation of Krishna, and that, you know, he and basically a lot of purport kind of is in there.
Yeah, which you might not get elsewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know about that very long and tremendously popular Mahabharata and Ramayana that was shown in India.
Mm.
How much of Krishna is in there?
Yeah.
But I saw one episode. I was in somebody's house, and two god brothers were watching that, and I went down and watched it. And they had these special effects for the war, and I thought they were kind of silly. And I went back upstairs. But the Peter Brook was not as far, far above that. Okay. So I wanted to chant together. So I'm just going to chant. We'll chant together for 5 minutes. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna Kripa asked us to read the Mahabharata after we read the essential books of Prabhupada. Also, we're discussing Janmashtami, about Krishna, original Krishna in Vrindavan, and when he leaves Vrindavan, how he's Vasudeva Krishna, expansion of Krishna. So in this section now, we'll talk about the original abode of Krishna, which is Vrindavan Dham. Prabhupada describes that Vrindavan in this world is a replica of the Vrindavan in the spiritual world, and he sometimes compares it to how a governor or a prime minister, aside from his main seat of office in the capital, when he travels or goes out of that place, he has another place, a state house somewhere else. So when Krishna leaves the spiritual world and comes to this world, on this planet, this is where he comes. Of course, it's very difficult to see that because of the covering of Kali Yuga, which is there to keep insincere people from being unable to see the original abode of Krishna. But those who approach in the right mood, they can gradually see with devotion that this is Krishna's abode. I've written a number of experiences of being in Vrindavan, and in the typical way I write, I don't write pretentiously, I don't pretend to have an experience that I didn't really have. So, and yet I try to see things with spiritual eyes, from the scriptures and what Prabhupada wanted us to see. So I'll read a few things, and then I'll ask you to I'll see how this goes. I'm not sure what the dynamic of this is going to be in the class, but it would be nice if Rai Ram had gotten here.
He's going to be here at 2 o'clock.
No, he's an expert relisher of Vrindavan, and he would get the mood rolling. But after I read, I'll ask. I know some of you also have been to Vrindavan, and don't be afraid to say, you don't have to get into some particular mood that that somebody is. I'm not trying to set a particular mood. Even go against it, and just everyone be honest. And then we can try to correct wrong visions, or not. Just be honest. Radhakunda, just say it simply. I'm reading from The Wild Garden, Collected Writings, 1990 to 1993. Say it simply. I offer my obeisances to Srila Prabhupada. He is my sole connection. Only by his permission do I come here. I have no knowledge of or taste for Radha Krishna's pastimes. I'm just a fool in a body. But I have this prana mantra engraved in my heart. I chant it as my heart's prayer again and again in Radha Kund. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swamini Ti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishisho Sunyavadi Paschatavade Satarane. I thought that was nice what Tulsi Priya Prabhu said yesterday, that everyone could at least come up to the Prabhupada Murti and just say, thank you Prabhupada, and then go away. By saying, no, I can't say anything, would mean that you don't even want to say thank you or whatever. But so I also, being in this very esoteric place, Vrindavan, feel, what prayer are you supposed to pray here, and what mood are you supposed to be in here? But I thought, as I'm on rock bottom, safe spiritual consciousness, if I just say these pranam mantras of Prabhupada, they are appropriate for Radha Kund. Nobody can say they're not. They are begging for rupees. We are drying off, wringing out our gumshas. It is immediately hot again. Something nice happened here. Submerge yourself in the water. Hold on to the chain because the steps are slippery. I see what my brother does, and I do it too. He cups his hands, dips them into the water, and then lifts them up to splash water on his head. It is delightful. I want to stay longer, but I don't like the turtles. They surface and look in my direction, and I hurry to finish my Gayatri. Even I have to laugh at what a superficial person I am, but it is all mercy. Anyone want to say something about Vrindavan?
No. Just reminded me of my last visit there and taking back the other kind to brought back memories. And how intense it is with all the pandas. Everyone trying to harass you and help you. Quite a week for me, and really have to stay focused on.
There was a good article, I thought, by, well, good, but it was the same thing. It was very good, but it was by Kalakanta about going to Vrindavan. He wrote it on about four different levels. One was being a parent of a child he was trying to introduce to Vrindavan. One was on the level of the Shastras, what is Vrindavan. Then himself, being a devotee who had gone there once and was coming again after many years, and perhaps another. But then he told of going to Radhakund, and it was really like a bitter experience. Right away, some panda accosted him and was trying to say, this place is here, this place is here. And Kalakanta turned to him and said, we know how to get to the places, or sir, we know how to get to the places. How much do I have to give you to go away? And then the man said in it like a cursing move, go back to Vrindavan, he said to me. And he said, I thought that was a good curse. But it's unfortunate that an innocent, you can call him a tourist, but an innocent, well-meaning devotee going to Vrindavan has to go through such a trip. Ignore them is very hard to do.
I found that was the easiest.
Yeah, don't look at them and don't speak to them. And yeah.
I went to Radhakund on the appearance of Radhakund.
Uh-huh.
And it's like midnight, you know. And I was sick that day. And I wasn't thinking of going, but Dinabandhu, he's so inspiring a speaker, and he said, we're going to do Harinam around this Radhakund, and it's the most sacred place in the universe. And I love Harinam so much that when he explained it like that, even though I was sick, I thought, well, I can't pass this up, I'll never get another chance like this one. So I ended up going anyway, and it was completely dark, and I was afraid if I got separated from the party that, you know, here I'd be all alone in the middle of it. It was really scary. And then some people were bathing and some people weren't bathing, and I wasn't sure. I thought I shouldn't, you know, because Bhaktisiddhanta, you know, took a few drops. So I did like that. And, you know, some lady wanted somebody to watch her clothes when she went bathing. And she asked me, and I was thinking, well, she should at least ask her husband, she's going to ask some guy. That was really strange. But we got back, and I remember there was those trains in India, and before, you know, the gates they put down 15 minutes before the train comes, and they take it up 15 minutes after it leaves, and they're ending it. In the bus for an extra half hour, and then I got back, but I had to speak through my guarantee because I got back. But it was such an amazing opportunity to go to Radhakund on that day, and I thought Krishna was really giving me such mercy to anybody do it.
Shilavati, I know you had a tough time. You want to say anything?
I know I had a tough time, but actually Radhakund was my favorite. My whole experience. Mahamantra came to my tent at 2 o'clock in the morning. She said, do you want to share my favorite time on Karthik? I said, yeah. And I got up and I thought, okay, this is going to be exciting. And we go down to Radhakund and she gets me a rock and shows me what to do. She showed me how to do Dandabat Parakha. And he has a go, oh, Moksha Rupa was with us as well. And I thought, oh my God. And then she went way ahead of me, and I thought, oh, I have to keep following her because I don't know the way, you know. So we had to, we did the full stand about paragraph, and it was really lovely, and I thought, oh my God. And I thought, I was completely black from head to toe, and I thought, oh, well, they'll be the same, you know, and I stood and I looked up at them at the end, and they were very spotless.
You did Dandapat Parikram of Radhakund?
Yeah, well, you know, every year growing up.
How long did it take?
I don't know.
That's wonderful.
That night she laughed at me and I went to the midnight. Even though she'd been exhausted after her flight from the park, I couldn't do that. But we went at midnight to the Kund, and we were so terrified. But there were just crowds and crowds of people.
Yeah.
And we tried to go down the steps, and a wave of people came against us just as we were down the steps trying to get out. And they were really strong Indian boys, you know, and they'd just been bathing, and they were in a really joyful mood, you know, but they were actually crushing women under their feet. They were all ages down on the steps, and they were walking all over them, you know. It was a huge swell of people coming against us. And we were literally almost carried off our feet and, you know, down the steps. And
the wall.
It was so scary, and we just cut onto the wall.
Yeah, we were held against the
wall. We were literally gripping our nails onto the wall, hanging on for dear life. Yeah.
There's no way I'm going to leave my body, because this is too auspicious.
I just keep chanting, and suddenly it was just peaceful, and we could walk down the steps, and we actually went in there. It was the most special moment ever, wasn't it? And I remember actually during my the experience that the water was so cooling and calming and beautiful after, you know, that crowd crushed heated after it had just been through. It was like the most soothing experience ever. And I remember trying to think I should think of Radharani, but all I could think of was, you know, Radharani is actually coming through you. So,
yeah,
that was my meditation.
I just
a nice feeling that
kindness
personified in you.
That
was my...
All right. That's great. So, I didn't know exactly what... it's wonderful to hear all your spontaneous experiences of Vrindavan, and we'll get a chance to do this every day. I wasn't sure exactly what to do with Prabhupada meditations. I've been reading these books lately and appreciating them. Four volumes, they really flowed one after another. It's a particular kind of book. It starts out with a lot of memories from 1966. Then it gets into actual meditations about the qualities of Prabhupada and so on. And there's a real abundance of it. And a particular way of doing it that's different than other books. But exactly, I don't like to do a lot of reading in a class. So I'm not so sure what to do with this. If we could talk about what it means to think of Prabhupada, that was our service yesterday. Radhanath said that he's a devotee of Prabhupada in his understanding of philosophy. So that's what we should be, and that's what these books are meant to do, to help us see things Prabhupada's way. And I'm glad that they're here as part of a library of thinking of Prabhupada. Somebody told me that in Bombay, the doctors in the hospital that has been started there are reading these books and like them very much. So anybody who is coming to Prabhupada's movement, after a while, if you catch on to these books, you know, you read and read and read, and then you want to read more, then you can come and read this also. Somebody asked me, I've written a lot of books over the years, which books are my favorites and things like that. I said an author likes to say that the most recent book he's writing is his favorite. Not that he's burned out doing things that aren't important, but there are things that I did early that I don't know if I can repeat again, with a lot of intensity of memories and meditations just on Prabhupada that are now in the world, and I hope we can keep them in print rather than they're going out of print. And that's what the Gita Nagari Press is for. I can tell you something that the Gita Nagari Press is doing. As you see, I'm not sure yet what we're going to do with this in our class, but there's one new thing going on with Gita Nagari Press is there's one devotee. Things are done more by computer now than by traveling around in vans. And there's one devotee of Prabhupada, Viswareda Prabhu. He used to do a lot of sankirtan out on the streets and airports. And he's 60 years old. He can't do that anymore, he says. And so he works with computers. And so by computer, he finds different university libraries, or public libraries, but mostly university libraries, would be willing to take a free set of Prabhupada's books plus 29 of my books. So it's done with this is done with mixed motivation by devotees who want to distribute books of the BBT and my disciples who want to distribute my books. So the BBT is quite happy to be part of this program, and my devotees are quite happy to be part of the program too, to be distributing Prabhupada's books along with mine. It's a very happy mixed motive. And so then I see the letters, they're wonderful letters, but the book librarians are quite happy to receive these books free. That's what they're being offered. And then Baladev and a couple of his assistants, their job is to collect the money. And they're quite good at that. They go around and find old friends, old disciples, and spend an evening with them and, cook a feast for them. And so sometimes after the whole thing, they're given $5. But sometimes after the evening, they're given more. There's one devotee, Gita Nagari Muktavanya, he gives them $400 a week. And they're getting different patrons. And so they're sending the books out to these people who want them free. And they've set up a kind of trust so that it will go on even after they're not here to do it. So this is a library program where these books are being distributed all over the world, not just the United States. And it gives you a good feeling that so one librarian wrote, "You have a precious legacy in our library, and I hope the students will read and benefit by your books." In other words, we really get a toehold in that library, that on and on in the future, our books can be read by their students. And you think in the world how there are different disasters and different places get knocked out, but there'll always be some place in the world where there'll be schools and libraries, and Prabhupada's books, and my books will be in the library there. So I'm pretty sure these four books are part of the 29 of mine that are in there. So I meditated. Here's one. It's called Swamiji's Attractive Beauty. I was on an extended writing retreat. I wrote this in a cabin in Saranagati, in northwest ISKCON place. And just throughout the day, I just stayed in that cabin. My whole purpose was just living together in the early days. And I wrote poems and so forth, and added to this series of meditations, remembering Prabhupada. Sometimes I justified why I should spend my time doing this. and told how meditation is as good as any act of physical service, and gave different references to that, and remembered Prabhupada, and invite people to also remember. Anyone have any questions or comments about people have read this book, these books? Have a particular flavor?
I just remember, I don't know if it, this is volume one?
Yeah.
I remember you were saying that you had a test, I mean, I can't remember exactly, but a generator which
exploded.
Oh, yes. And one of your disciples who came across, I can't remember exactly.
Lalitamita.
Yeah, of course. America.
Yeah.
There and accident.
Or yeah, all these things. Yeah, all the, I think that's under here. I just passed it. Opposition. That Baladev is fond of seeing things that way. That when you really start doing something big for Krishna, then Maya takes note and really starts giving you opposition. So, yeah, Lalitamrita was the typist, and she was in a car accident, and the car turned over, and she was unconscious, and I think a tape recorder was playing Prabhupada, and somebody came by and saw her and said, "Are you all right?" or something, and brought her to consciousness. But then, you know, that person really didn't want to stay and help her, so he left. And then electricity blew out, so they were using a generator, and all these different things happened. That was under opposition, you know, fighting and fighting to get our job done. Because my writing process is that, oh yeah, here it is, opposition. Our meditations are threatened by breakdowns. One of the typists has asthma, the other hay fever. I also have hay fever. My personal assistant has asthma, and for this he is fasting. He recommends that the typists fast, but if they do, how will they be able to work? Since we're up in the country with no electricity, we have been using a 10-year-old Chinese generator for the electric typewriters, because that's how I work, that I write by hand and then I dictate it on a dictaphone, and then they need electric typewriters. Last week the generator had to be taken in for repairs, but this morning it blew a piston. We may have to buy a new one, but where's the money? Baladev claims that these breakdowns are evidence that we are working at an important project. Lesser evils are the attacks of ants and mosquitoes. Every day we try new schemes to outsmart them without killing them. Yesterday while riding in the woods, a black bear cub approached me within 30 feet, and then I saw the mother bear, who could have ended my life with a few swipes. I've been thinking about that ever since. Sometimes when I try to place myself 2 feet away from Swamiji in his room, that means I meditate, a black bear roams into my mind's eye. If I manage to control my mind, then the cries of the juvenile ravens as they fly after their mother are enough to pierce through almost anyone's samadhi. Aside from this, I am harassed by doubts and pride in my writing. I am not the creator, not the doer, but I forget this. And so every hour I am turning to Krishna and Prabhupada, bowing down before them. I want to surrender and say only what you approve. But neither can you sit back and sleep on your chariot and expect Krishna to do your work for you. Therefore, to surrender also means to write whatever you can before it's too late, before the memories die out. As you are right now, remember your spiritual master. Choose a passage from Prabhupada's books and read it as deeply as you can. Meditate against the opposition. Prabhupada describes the goal. A truly Krishna-conscious person, always absorbed in transcendence, in constant undisturbed meditation on his worshipable Lord, is as steady as a lamp in a windless place. Bhagavad Gita 6:19. Purport. We all have that, so many oppositions, and have to overcome them. Kind of laugh at them in some sense and then never give up, like Aniruddha said yesterday. Thank you for bringing that up. It helped me get into the book somewhere. It's a sugar doll book, but I don't know exactly how to get into it in different places. Maybe if some of the, well, I don't know if the books are available here, but you could look at different things and ask me about it.
I believe that there's some of those on the island, and I've got here also. Oh.
Yes?
Sometimes it feels like more opposition to devotees than non-devotees. Can you say something about that? How it seems that there are always just so much opposition, and the bigger the project we're trying to do, the more.
Devotees have more opposition than
them? It seems that there's like, you know, some people seem to like just go very smoothly in their life, but a lot of devotees, you see that their life is really quite tough at times and difficult, and there seems to be, even like when we're trying to engage in a project for Krishna,
Well, one thing is that if we do have difficulties, that their quality is different. They're purifying us. They're not just difficulties that don't give us any benefit. They're difficulties by which we can surrender to Krishna. So even like that, like the Pandavas had so many difficulties, perhaps more than an average man who stayed at home, but the difficulties enabled them to think of Krishna. I don't know if it's true that devotees have more difficulties than others, but if they do, we should not complain. I remember one woman who was having a child, and her neighbor had a child, and the devotee woman had great difficulty giving birth to the child, although she finally did, the child was all right. But the next door neighbor, she had no difficulty at all. The devotee became had like a brick in her faith in Krishna. Why should I have to go through like this? And the other person doesn't, so her husband asked me to speak to her about it, and I don't remember exactly what I said, but I was trying to ask her not to see things with resentment towards Krishna or her being a Krishna conscious devotee. We don't become a devotee thinking that I will get easier material treatment. I remember a man who joined the temple out of material misery because of a divorce. He suffered a divorce, but then he didn't get a better, his life didn't turn better materially, and so he was disappointed on that score. But it's for spiritual relief that we surrender to Krishna. And if a person is in this material world looking for material relief, they really can't get it. One way or another, material misery comes to everyone in this life or the next. Is it really true, even factually or statistically? I don't know if that's true, what you said, that devotees suffer more. We have enough prasadam, we have association with like-minded people in a God-conscious way. We can say, oh, I have this problem with the devotees, I quarrel with these devotees, and so, but so many ways Krishna always gives us even the basic material necessities. Prabhupada claimed that, I heard in some lectures that in India, even when there were the famines, he said he always somehow got enough, and he asked his friends in Calcutta and in the Mayapur area who were in this line, meaning in this Gaudiya Sampradaya, he asked them, how did you manage? And they said, oh no, we managed somehow. So he was saying that somehow or other Krishna would provide for them. You've heard that on the tape? We don't worship Krishna for that. But it seems that Like he says, yogic shama vaham yaham. I give my devotees what they lack and I maintain what they have. We can take that as spiritually, but materially also. And if he doesn't give what we want materially, then I take that as his mercy also. Okay, stop now. Thank you. Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai.